Bitcoin fixes this because it removes the ability of all of these other forces to continue to finance their incentives. So if you remove the government's ability to print money and then spend it, they won't be able to pay for things like emission standards.
The state of Texas is moving forward with its strategic state Bitcoin reserve in a move that might signal the start of a broader trend for provincial or regional governments to insulate themselves from federal level money printing using Bitcoin. And this week we are talking about how Bitcoin could potentially reshape the geopolitical landscape, international borders, and how we think about organizing society on the whole with Bitcoin as a catalyst for change. And our guest this week is our favorite Alberta separatist, board of director member of Block Rewards, and Canada's longest running Bitcoin entrepreneur, Dave Bradley. Somebody that I always learn a ton from every time I get the chance to talk to him, and today was no different. I hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by special return guest, Dave Bradley, the smartest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada. Dave, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. This is a mistake that some people have been making lately.
Oh, it's the strongest.
Yeah, I've never claimed to be the smartest, but you know, there's a lot of smart people in Bitcoin, and especially among Bitcoin entrepreneurs, there's a lot of smart people, but when you add strongest and best looking, that's where my actual title comes from.
Unquestioned. I love it. I hope that, you know, this episode, we're going to exercise the demons of the Dave Bradley podcast. You were on the show almost 2 years ago now, one of our first episodes. And it was the first time I was still like a young podcaster back then. And there was an audio error with that episode. We salvaged it. It was a great conversation, but something went wrong there. And then actually, this episode will be the third time we've tried to record a podcast, because recently we tried to record an in-studio one the last time you were here visiting in Kelowna a couple months back, and experienced an audio boo-boo that time as well and lost a great conversation. So hopefully we've triple-checked everything, and we're going to produce something that is listenable today.
Yeah, I mean, we've both done this a few times. We should be able to pull it off.
Yeah, I know. Also, you're among the people I talk most with about Bitcoin, and so that it's been this long is a little bit of a funny eyesore, I suppose.
Yeah.
So we were talking last time in the conversation that didn't air about one of your pet topics. You've got a running segment that you do that's called Bitcoin Fixes Things, whereby you attempt to explain a Bitcoin solution to a fiat normal world problem and accept any takers. So I guess that's the premise of where we're starting today.
Yeah.
And we discussed this offline, but you're going to take on the car industry.
Yeah. So we did the airline industry, which I think I've done a write-up on somewhere, but the car industry is really similar, and it's a really, really glaring fiat problem, right? And so this is the way that I think Bitcoin fixes the car industry. Essentially, you've got all these competing incentives right now that are not the incentives of the purchaser, right? And all of these are coming pretty directly from the fiat machine and the pieces that the fiat machine enables, right? And so what you actually have is the fiat money printing and the cheap credit that is poured into the economy gets used to prop up this massive vehicle financing bubble. So we've got more vehicles financed in North America than we ever have, more dollars worth of financing, and people are financing larger and larger percentages of their income and stretching those vehicle financings over a longer and longer period of time. So essentially the entire car industry is just a big leverage bubble. And meanwhile, the car companies are not actually making very much money by selling these cars. They're making money off of the financing charges, and they're making money off of the service that they offer the cars after the fact. And so now that there is all this cheap money, there's a very easy way for a person to afford a very expensive car. And therefore, the manufacturers who are deciding how they make these cars end up making more and more expensive cars, because the more parts that you put into a car, the more doohickeys and sensors and things that beep at you and all these different features and lane warnings and everything that you have in a modern car, these are not things that you need in a car. These are not even really things that you know, I would say that the majority of people would pay that much more for. But now they've all become standard in these more and more expensive cars. And, you know, it's just that many more things that can break. And so me as a consumer, you know, if I'm buying a car, like the main thing that I want it to do is to drive me around, right? I might want it to look nice. I might want it to be comfortable, have good climate control, good visibility, good control on the road. So there's a lot of things that my incentives would actually support, but these are not necessarily what's being built into the new cars, right? Like if you go and you drive a 1996 Civic, that is going to be just as good in most of the ways that I described in terms of getting you around, you know, being a good and comfortable car that is safe and that you can actually drive in, as compared to something now that costs 6-7 times as much, that has, you know, a million different warnings and beeping noises, and, you know, it turns the gas off automatically at the light so that you don't waste fuel, and it has all of these emission standards built in that you know, also are not in my best interests. Those are the interests of the climate cult who have twisted the regulations and incentivized governments to act in their best interests. And that too is put into the incentive system that determines what's in a car. And so really it's just this giant mess of financing manufacturers that are not incentivized to make what the customer wants, and other government funded incentives twisting again what the car actually is. You know, now we've got cars designed to burn corn so that we can support the corn industry, right? These incentive systems are coming from really every single direction. And Bitcoin fixes this because it removes the ability of all of these other forces to continue to finance their incentives. So if you remove the government's ability to print money and then spend it, they won't be able to pay for things like emission standards. If you remove all of the cheap money that gets poured into the world, people won't be able to finance cars that are, like, you know, nearly their entire salary. I mean, in some cases, their entire salary, and stretch that over many years at a very cheap cost. And so ultimately, what we will, I hope, return to is a scenario where companies compete to design cars that people want more at a price that is more competitive than the other guy. And that's really the essence of what free markets are supposed to be. And, you know, that is, I think, something that we can get back to with Bitcoin. So that is how Bitcoin fixes the car industry.
There's like a lot of different threads that I want to pull on now. So maybe we can stay here for a second. I think it's a really good example to start with. So firstly, this problem of asset prices and liquidity. And it's like something that I think we really have just become so accustomed to, the idea of paying down things over time, borrowing and paying down things at a later date in the future. And then the price of these things, and this applies to everything. And like there's even inside that, this mechanism where the car companies are continually trying to get you to trade in to reset the amount that you financed so that nobody even really plans to pay this thing off. And they're just compounding and effectively, like, often I think losing on a lot of these trades where they're just adding more and more debt. And, you know, I guess if you could really even like distill down further this concept of what devaluing money means for a consumer versus appreciating money, like, you know, at the ground floor, how does that change the buyer's decision and how they're thinking about entering into an arrangement even like that in the first place?
Yeah. So it does a few things. When you introduce all of this very cheap money into the economy, you really start to just create this situation where the demand for things becomes somewhat inelastic or somewhat elastic. And so essentially what goes on is that normally what you'd have in an economy that's functioning properly in a free market is that the producers of anything will have to try to figure out the correct pricing. And some people will price it too high, some people will price it too low. The market will give them feedback and they'll figure out what something is worth. But when there is no real limit on the spending power, because they're always just going to pump more money in, you know, it creates this scenario where the market doesn't really get to decide. It's the liquidity that decides the price. And so, you know, if you can get an $80,000 car loan, they're going to sell you an $80,000 car. essentially what it comes down to. And that comes in a lot of different markets when they're distorted, is that the you know, we see it in the healthcare system. The prices will increase to the point where they get what they think they can charge from the insurance company, who is not the interested party. And it's the same with the auto industry, right? The lending will keep inflating, and the car companies will base the price of the car and the amount, you know, they'll add all these features, all these bells and whistles to try to justify the price of the car, but they're building towards the price that they think they can get financing for, that the average person can get financing for, rather than trying to find a market competitive spot where, you know, realistically, a car that was a lot more like a 1996 Civic, you know, what the car that I want is a 1996 Civic with a backup camera, you know, pretty similar to what it was in 1996. The backup camera I find pretty useful. Most of those other features I don't. And, you know, something that you can fix yourself for basic repairs, something that isn't designed to have, you know, electronics and sensors breaking every so often and be just a constant money pit. And I think a car like that, which you could probably sell for a lot less money than the current version of the Honda Civic or anything comparable in the market right now with all these extra things, you know, sensors, bells and whistles, I think that would outcompete the cars that are on the market now. But they have no incentive to do that because the money's there. So they can just keep making the most expensive cars that they want. And, you know, we get the results of cheap money. And the flip side of that is that on a Bitcoin standard, eventually, you know, the competition will be to get somebody to part with something that is much more scarce, obviously. And so the, you know, if you want my sats, you better make me a good product. And I think that's kind of a general attitude that a lot of Bitcoiners have. And, you know, when your purchasing power is likely to go up over time, if you think that there might be a better product coming soon, you're probably going to wait for that better product. You know, you're going to take your time on purchasing decisions, and you're going to be incentivized to buy something that will last long enough that you're not embarrassed by the relative change in your purchasing power, right? So I've told the story many times of spending ungodly amounts of Bitcoin buying furniture for my first Bitcoin store. And, you know, I only have one piece of furniture left, but I'd have millions of dollars if I'd kept those Bitcoin, right? And so in that case, it would have obviously been much better. It would have been in my best interest to buy less furniture, you know? And so, or buy furniture that I knew I was going to want for a long time. And so I think that's kind of like the major fundamental shift that we're going to see in people's behavior, is when you start thinking in a form of money that will appreciate over time versus this melting ice inflating balloon. You know, your incentives align much more directly with whatever purchase you're making. And so you probably make your incentive also is to pursue the competition, pursue the best value for the price, and make sure that you're getting, you know, a product that's actually worth the money that you're spending and that will be worth that in the future also.
And maybe just as a very short segue for our listeners who aren't familiar with you, you were very early to Bitcoin and had I might also get this wrong, the first brick and mortar Bitcoin store in Canada. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're speaking from experience. Yeah, I guess the naysayers will say, well, that may not continue to be true over the next 15 years of Bitcoin and what happened over the first 15 years, but the phenomenon that you're expecting to unfold, that you're talking about right now, is the result of yourself having actually lived through this over the last 15 years.
Yeah. And so it's not going to be the same exponential gains that it was. There just isn't room for those same kind of gains at the same pace again. But, you know, looking at those choices, would I buy that furniture again or would I rather have the Bitcoin back? Obviously, I'd rather have the Bitcoin because those gains were so much larger than what we're likely to see in the future.
You know, I wonder about that just because the flip side could be that fiat money could lose its value at a much faster rate.
Yeah. And there will be a point where fiat money loses all of its value. And so if you're still counting things in dollars, when dollars go to infinity, you know, like it'll be kind of irrelevant. But I think that'll be, as the saying goes, gradually, then suddenly. And in the gradually period, it's very likely that, you know, Bitcoin is probably going to continue to appreciate it against the dollar. And, you know, it's, I think, very likely, if you were to average it out, to still be in those, like, you know, 20 to 40% annual gains on average at that kind of a rate of increase of purchasing power, you can actually still make a logical decision to buy something. You know, if you make the decision to buy something and you know that it's going to be 10,000 times cheaper next year, that's probably a bad choice, right? Like, you should probably just wait at that scale. But at 20 to 40%, you can still make purchases, you know, live in the moment without having to sacrifice all that much, you know, in terms of purchasing power, as long as the thing that you're buying is worth it in the stats of tomorrow. So that's kind of the shift that I'm describing. And that's really the very, very opposite of what the entire auto industry is right now. It's just like this inflated mess, essentially.
I mean, it's kind of the counter backwards way of looking at just about everything, right? We spend money faster now because we know we'll be worth less tomorrow, and the likelihood of the thing we want costing more is high. So we have the reverse. And I think this is also partly how people who are less further along in their understanding of Bitcoin, how they're actually thinking about Bitcoin, you know, is like, how soon am I going to be able to sell it back into dollars and get as many dollars as I can?
That's where most people get started with Bitcoin. You know, I was there for many years. I had a plan to sell my Bitcoins for dollars. And, you know, eventually you just, it's like, what would be the point of that? What would I do with the dollars?
Yeah. The other thing maybe to come around back to on this thing with the auto industry is, you know, like, they're making these like ultra high-end vehicles in China that would be $10,000 here if you were allowed to sell them for that here. And you can't, because the other piece of what you're talking about is the centralized intervention in the free market economy. And which relates to money printing, you know, and we did see like cars, whatever, cottages, real estate, like when everyone got free money in 2020, we saw like a near immediate explosion in the cost of kind of luxury items. So maybe let's just talk a little bit about that phenomenon and, you know, see where that goes.
Yeah. The central planning in the market is pretty significant. And, you know, the one thing that we didn't even get to is the unionist intervention, which is a big part of what drives that culture, that price, really, right? Like, a huge percentage of the price of modern cars and car parts is because all those people are unionized and are essentially in a mafia structure, extorting the businesses for higher wages than the market would bear if it was a free market. And the government's incentive is to continue to prop up those unions because they want the votes. You know, the collectivist governments, which is really the only ones that we have, want those union votes. And so allowing the unions to essentially extort these businesses at the expense of consumers is a way to get those union votes. And, you know, from the consumer's perspective, because there's so much free money, they're able to just sort of amortize that exploitation. And it doesn't seem as bad because they get to drive a fancy car with a bunch of bells and whistles that makes them feel like they've made it in the world. But, you know, it's not actually a more useful vehicle than that 1996 Civic. So it really has been twisted from every single direction. And yeah, I mean, the government's intervention in any facet of the economy basically always goes the same way, right? It ends up having nearly immediate unintended consequences because the people who are making those decisions, who believe that with this massive hubris, believe that they are smart enough to model and control the entire economy by pulling some levers and, you know, making laws that put lines in the economy that those of us who are actually creating value have to follow without actually having any understanding of what those laws or regulations will cause on the second order effects. And that's pretty much the story of every single thing that every government has ever done in the world. They're just meddling with things that they don't understand in a way that they think they understand. And the unintended consequences always cause problems, which the government always responds to with more meddling. And really, it's, you know, it's why we've gotten to this point in the world where so many of us are just like, leave us alone, please leave us alone. And yeah, stop helping, please. And Bitcoin is the antidote, right? It's the way to get them to stop helping.
So, okay. So that's a great second how does Bitcoin fix this question? And how does Bitcoin fix the government?
Yeah, Bitcoin fixes the government in a really direct and simple way, because right now the government has two ways to confiscate resources from us. They can use their monopoly on violence to confiscate them directly in ways like taxes and service fees and whatnot. And the other way that they can do it is to just print money. And the big, big difference, it's a major psychological difference that impacts the nature of the relationship between the individual and the government, is that when they print money, they don't have to look you in the eyes. So they can just print this money and spend it, and prices go up and people blame grocery stores, right? They blame global warming, they blame tariffs and the trade wars, and they blame everything except for the fact that their money is not as rare as it used to be, and so it's not as valuable as it used to be. And that has obviously, over the last 100 years, been the government's preferred method of confiscating resources. And, you know, it's ramped up to the point where they're printing way more money than they ever have. On the flip side, if they want to tax you, they have to tell you that they're taxing you. They're taking from you. And that feeling of having something taken from you is something that is a lot more visceral, and something that a lot more people will object to when they can see it and feel it directly. You know, I would estimate that governments in the Western world right now are confiscating and redistributing somewhere in the area of 80 to 90% of all of the resources of society. But because taxes are a lot lower than that, it feels like a lot less. But if the government no longer had the ability to print and spend money, and had to only rely on spending money that it could borrow, which if it couldn't print money, its borrowing capacity would go way down, or get through taxes and other revenues, the government would be forced to either stop spending so much or go bankrupt or drastically increase taxes, which, you know, when the government, I feel like if the average person were seeing 80 to 90% of their income taken away on their paycheck every 2 weeks, I think the reaction to that would be a lot stronger even than the, you know, the current rates that are exorbitantly high already, considering that the United States was formed over a 3% tax on tea. Now everyone in the world's being taxed like 40 to 60%.
Like, it's higher than like the serfs in ancient Egypt were paying in tax.
Yeah, it's incredibly high. And that's not even including the money printing. So the actual amount that they're confiscating and either stealing or redistributing is staggering. It's like never before seen levels in human history. We're nearing the point of, you know, the government, the state owning the means of production, owning everything. Yeah. And they have obviously been pushing this as a sort of new angle on the global war for communism, right? The same people who set up the Bolsheviks, set up the Federal Reserve, and have been looting us for, you know, 700 years or so. They're not giving up. They want us to own nothing and be happy. And Bitcoin fixes this because it takes away the covert way of stealing from us, and I hope will cause them to either steal less or face the wrath of the plebs. You know, I want people to feel the pain. And I think the government, up until the governments of the world, the globalists, up until COVID recently, were doing a really good job of knowing how far they could push. And that's how we got to this point where, you know, like you say, we're way over the tax levels of the Egyptian serfs. It's been a frog in boiling water, right? They've turned it up slowly, 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 and given us lots of bribes to sort of, you know, give a reason for their grift, right? Like they've bribed the people as many times as they can with different sort of entitlements. But yeah, my feeling is that if they're going to continue on this path, you know, it's going to reach an impasse when they lose that ability to print, because Bitcoin takes away their inferior form of money's value. You know, we're going to have some angry people, and that's when things can really change very quickly and in a very final and shocking way for the thieves.
So for like a more middle road, you know, thought on how this gets resolved, as the government experiences a diminished ability to steal, how does it continue to function? Because that's, I think, kind of like the normal, the mainstream idea of like, well, that'll never happen.
Yeah. So I think what we're going to see is very similar to what we're seeing right now in Alberta here, where the incentives are going to be that the more useful places in the world will want to separate themselves from the less useful places in the world. So the Sovereign Individual, great book that everybody should read, predicts that the day of the large-scale nation state is done. And I think that's very much true. I think we're going to see, probably starting with Canada, but followed by very large nations around the world, we're going to see a balkanization of a lot of the countries in the world. And by removing, you know, multiple, in some cases, levels of government, bringing local interests back to the jurisdictions and restoring a little bit of sanity, I think there are going to be places in the world that are able to move their governments in the right direction and basically shrink the size of government. You know, we've got to eliminate the absolutely insane grift that's going on with our government spending, where there's seemingly no tether to reality whatsoever. And, you know, we're still spending unprecedented amounts of money. We're still spending money on all these pet DEI projects all around the world. We're still wasting money into NGOs that are really just money funnels to the friends of the elite. I think we will be in a position in a lot of places to get to a point where we can rein that in. You know, there's going to be a lot more where they can't rein it in. And in those places, they're going to be facing some really lean times at some point when, you know, they run into the question of how do we pay the men with guns who maintain our monopoly on violence? And that's something that we saw in Venezuela, was the fact that, you know, when their currency completely exploded, the military and the police stopped being willing to take Venezuelan bolivars and they needed a better form of money to pay them. And, you know, the US dollar was the better form of money. They started paying the military in US dollars and are to this day. And I expect we're going to see something really similar to that in a lot of places in the world, especially places that are last to realize that they need to reach this form of austerity and rein in their insane scale and spending. Those are probably also going to be the last places that would have been likely to buy Bitcoin. And they're going to have some really bad times. They're going to end up with very bankrupt cities who can no longer really provide much in the way of any services, if they can even provide services to maintain their monopoly on violence. If not, some of these places may collapse entirely. But I think we're going to have both of those kinds of societies going forward. And the ones that are able to rein that whole thing in, which I hope is something we're going to be able to do in Alberta, I'm hoping that an independent Alberta will yield a lot less government overall, a lot more individual freedoms, and a lot more economic freedom, which ultimately is just going to benefit everyone. And, you know, I think we're going to see kind of both paths. We're going to see the real collapse of modern communism and the thriving of new enclaves of a new wave of capitalism and free markets. So I'm optimistic for that. But yeah, I think it could go either way in just about everywhere. I'm hoping Alberta is going to be on the right side of this one. You guys over in Kelowna,
I hope we can come with you.
I mean, I think we'd really like to buy the interior of BC if we can manage it at some point, because it's very culturally aligned and, you know, everyone in Calgary has a vacation home in Kelowna. So we'd be a good fit. But the rest of BC, Vancouver, the coast down there, Victoria, that feels like one of those areas that may be a lost cause, that is just not going to get their shit together until it's way too late. And then they will be left with the consequences of their choices, the consequences of Marxism that always end up the same way.
Hey, everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else: editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast, or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough.
check them out.
Maybe to come back to something you said about the sovereign individual and James Dale, it's a really interesting conversation you and I have had a few times about the obsolescence of the superstate. And so maybe I'd love for you to just expand on a little bit more. And what does Bitcoin have to do with it? You know, this is kind of forth turning ideas. And, you know, I sort of do agree with the general concept that we can go wrong, assuming for the most part that 15 years from now is going to look pretty similar to what looks like right now, just because right now looks kind of similar to what 15 years ago looked like. And, you know, that's true until it isn't true. And yeah.
Yeah. So the broad theory is that the end of the mega state is here because of a change in the logic around violence. And essentially for most of human history, you had whichever nation state was able to concentrate the most resources and then apply them to violence was generally going to be the safest. And so, and that's what the core idea behind the nation state is to keep us safe, to keep our capital safe, to allow us to build and grow in a place that does not at risk of confiscation. And so, you know, going back over history, whichever country had the most knights or the most ships or the most planes would have been the safest country. And those things required resources that scaled pretty linearly. You know, you have 10 times as much gold, you can buy 10 times as many ships. And that really started to change in the last century for a couple of reasons. One is that the invention of fiat currency really removed the limit on how many resources could be concentrated by any one entity. And really with the you know, the sort of invention of the petrodollar and the US global reserve currency, it really gave to the United States the power to concentrate a virtually unlimited amount of resources and put them into that that pursuit of the magnitude of violence. But over that same time frame, that need for the magnitude of violence has changed because the nuke was kind of like the maximum, you know, assuming nukes exist. The nuke was kind of like the maximum, and they do exist at least in concept. So that concept is it puts a ceiling on how much violence is useful to keep a nation state safe. And so a country with, you know, 5 nukes is going to be pretty much as safe as a country with 1,000 nukes, because the outcome of launching those nukes is so significant that it creates a scenario where no one has an incentive to go to war with them. And so what that has meant since then is that there's no real incentive to continue to concentrate those resources and increase that magnitude of violence. And what's ended up being more important in the last 70 years or so is a change to the efficiency of violence being more important. And so things like the AK-47, you know, you had these rice farmers with a gun that cost the same as a chicken who were able to defeat the entire magnitude of violence that the mass of the United States military was able to put together. And so really what that means is at the end of the day, the core ideal behind why we needed a large-scale nation state is gone, right? We don't need that concentration of resources anymore. And the things that hold together a large-scale nation state at this point are all of the extra layers that the bureaucracy of the world have built on top of that core ideal of the nation state over the last, you know, 1500 years. And the idea that the government and the state is really all of these other layers that, you know, have always existed and will always exist, I don't think is true. And that's the part that we're getting into challenging is like, which of those layers do we as individuals actually want? Do we want to be subsidizing these, you know, these pet projects? And, you know, my favorite one that I saw was the group that was spending something like $40 million to educate the wives of Afghan tribesmen about modern art. And so it's like just completely detached from reality. And we're getting to a point now where when you combine the fact that Bitcoin changes their ability to tax us secretly with the fact that we can now have, you know, so much more freedom of information, we can see these things like what they're spending our money on in Afghanistan. When those forces collide, and you start to see the individual being forced with the choice of, you know, do I need this? Do I need this large overarching structure? Do I need, as an individual living in the province of Alberta, do I need the government of Canada? And really the answer is no. It's quite clear that I don't need the government of Canada. They they take so much more from me and from my community than they give me. It's gotten to the point where it's so vastly not even close that basically everyone can see it. And they've really just, they've pushed too far too many times. And I don't even think they know that because they're still doing it. Like they're still attempting these absolutely insane climate alarmist agendas, trying to eliminate gas vehicles by 2035. Just things that are so drastically against the best interests of the people of Alberta, let alone the rest of the people of Canada. That's, I think, where the nation state has had its day. And we don't need them as much anymore for the things that we really needed them for once. And we certainly don't need them for all the extra stuff that they tacked on.
And you didn't even mention this explicitly, but the notion that they played an important role for a long time in protecting people's property rights. And the Bitcoin actually also fixes that by providing us with property that's incredibly difficult to confiscate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awkward pause. Maybe let's talk about Alberta a little bit. There's been, you know, Texas has passed its strategic state reserve. And maybe let's start there first. So we're seeing now sub jurisdictions inside super states move towards Bitcoin positions and thinking about a Bitcoin future. And Alberta has talked about it, or like, you know, people have hope for it. So, you know, forget about Alberta or Texas. They're like, what does that mean? Like, well, what does that step signal?
Yeah, it's a couple things. One is that the reason that Alberta would buy Bitcoin is the same as why an individual would buy Bitcoin, is because when the government of Alberta attempts to save money in dollars, the federal government will be printing more, and so they will be losing purchasing power. And in a scenario where Alberta, you know, at very least is trying to get a lot more autonomy within Canada, and I believe is very likely to be separating from Canada for and seeking our independence, in those kind of scenarios, we want to remove as many ways as possible for the government, the federal government, to take advantage of us. And printing more dollars is just one of those ways. And so the province of Alberta holding Bitcoin in a strategic Bitcoin reserve would just be an attempt to avoid the inflation that otherwise afflicts every entity and person in the country. And so I think that's a pretty direct and logical thing to do. There is also, like you mentioned, the property rights issue, which is a murky area between the province and the federal government. There have been repeated attempts by the federal government to step over the lines of provincial jurisdiction and violate the rights of the province. And there have also been, as we've seen just recently, a lot of sort of financial censorship going on in Canada with Operation Chokepoint. Anybody who's involved in the Bitcoin industry, even somebody who just goes to buy their first Bitcoin, risks having their bank account closed down. And anybody who, you know, is tied to these sort of like unacceptable fringe opinions, the idea that we should be free, and those who speak about it are subject to having their bank accounts closed down. And we just saw that with Eva Chipiak, the lawyer for that had cross-examined Trudeau after the trucker convoy, had her RBC account shut down. And so the idea that the federal government could engage in that kind of financial censorship against the province of Alberta at some point is absolutely likely, I would say, depending on how, you know, whether we separate quickly, whether there's a longer dispute and how things end up going. You know, the idea that the government of Alberta might want to have some capital that is not confiscatable by the federal government, I think is a very good idea also. And so I think it's obviously the right choice for the province to go to the strategic Bitcoin reserve. And it does sound like they're smart enough to stay away from all the other nonsense coins, from what I've heard anyway. So that's a good piece. But yeah, I think it's like one extra leg that we as Albertans can stand on in our hope for independence and freedom from the tyrannical overlords that we have now in Ottawa. Yeah, I think it's one of the many sort of legs of freedom. And there's some interesting conversation, you know, if we were to separate, if we became an independent nation, what would we use as our currency? And the smart move would be Bitcoin. That'd be the most transformational thing that could be done. If we went full Bitcoin and completely opened up the oil industry, Alberta would permanently be the richest country in the world. And I don't think there'd be any, I don't think there's any chance that it wouldn't go that way if we did that. But Bitcoin is still a harder sell to the normies. You know, they're starting to get the fact that they need freedom, but a lot of them don't get the impact that that money printing and fiat have on their freedom at this point.
I mean, a lot of people who are into Bitcoin actually don't prioritize the freedom part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's still a lot of people who are here for number go up technology and the idea that they want more dollars, which is fine. But there is a middle ground that I think is actually quite likely, especially if we do get a strategic Bitcoin reserve going, is that, you know, maybe Alberta issues a new currency, and this has been in the proposals from the Alberta Prosperity Project, a new currency that would be backed by hard assets. So it would namely be gold, Bitcoin, and oil that would back a new currency, which I think would be a tremendously powerful currency and something that, you know, would vastly outperform every other kind of fiat and really would, like, it would make a true Bitcoin, it would make a true Bitcoin standard a lot less necessary in Alberta if we had a currency like that.
There's been different ideas, you know, like the, if whether there's any smoke here or not, but the concept of a BRICS currency with Brazil, Russia, India, and China has also floated around different commodity-backed concepts, gold and oil. And, you know, I guess this is part of what, were the United States to proceed with some kind of strategic Bitcoin reserve, this would be part of that too. You know, do you think that the next likely step is actually just paper money being backed by hard assets? Or, you know, if you had to guess, like, where it's going?
Yeah, that would be probably my guess. I think there's a faction of the global elites, the Trump camp, for example, that have realized that currency needs to be at least recapitalized, if not completely restructured. And having a basket of commodities that backs a currency, I think, in a lot of ways, would achieve a lot of what you had under a gold standard. It wouldn't be as hard of money, because a lot of those, you know, if you had every country in the world trying to stock up oil reserves in order to back their currency, then you'd probably increase the price of oil. And, you know, so you have these underlying market forces where the commodities can respond to the demand created by the fact that they are the backing, in which case, you know, if you increase the price of oil, you increase the production of oil and therefore the supply of oil, and your money is not as hard as it used to be. So I think it would probably be a mix of those things. They'd probably want things that are harder like gold and things that are even harder like Bitcoin. And we'll still be in a scenario where the world has competing currencies, and the ones that pick a better basket of resources, which obviously the best basket you can pick is just Bitcoin, the ones that pick the better baskets will win.
There's also this Alberta should be like Dubai, right? Where, yeah, I guess if you're eliminating all this sort of bureaucratic fat, then you could imagine it being a smaller nation that is able to compete for business and, you know, citizens based on having maybe almost no taxes, and a positive flywheel that would make it even more productive.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of different layers of collectivism. And the interesting one that I've decided that I'm okay with, that we have as an assumption here right now, is that as Albertans, we own all of the oil. So you don't own the oil under your land if you own land in Alberta. And I think that is the right way to determine that, because the oil just doesn't really work that way, right? You can get oil by drilling on your land that is beneath other people's lands, and it's unavoidable. And so I think the idea that we all own the oil is something that I can live with, because it makes sense, and it also would serve a pretty good purpose. And I think that purpose could be that we in Alberta could get to a point where we, like you say, have essentially no taxes, and the only revenues that the government brings in, which the government is the representative of the collectivism, would be oil royalties. And I think we could go with a fairly low oil royalty. We can be competitive with the rest of the world, certainly, because if we had that kind of a scenario where the government just got out of the way on everything, our oil industry would be in such a boom. We'd be producing so much oil that a relatively low royalty would actually pay for, you know, quite a lot of what the government wants to offer. And I think, especially when you pair that with the idea of sort of bringing some sanity back to government you know, we've had a movement to do that already. We've got a premier who's going after the bureaucracy. And I think that that's badly needed. We have a very, very inflated bureaucracy, especially in our healthcare system. Yeah, we could be, like you say, we could be Dubai. We could be the most thriving economy in the world. You know, if we did that, unleashing the oil industry and went to a Bitcoin standard as one of the first or the first country in the world to actually do that, that's where I say, you know, we should be permanently the richest country in the world. That's where that idea comes in. If we just unleashed the oil industry, had low and competitive royalties, and put all of the savings into Bitcoin, we would literally be the richest country in the world forever.
It's a vision of a reimagined world of tomorrow. I know, like, there's a possibility for a referendum in the near future. Like, zooming out again, like, maybe not Alberta specifically, like, how, on what time frame do you think that this, you know, end of the super state, is this a 50-year thing? Is it a 20-year thing?
Well, one of the interesting things in the sovereign individual when they're predicting this, and this book came out in, like, I think 1995, they predicted that Canada would be the first major nation state to crumble. And they pointed out that one of the reasons that it would crumble is because of Alberta. And so predicting Alberta separating in 1995 is a pretty crazy pick. But, you know, the way that they pointed it out is that we're so far apart. We're so culturally disparate. And, you know, we were singled out by one of the leaders of the Quebec separatists there telling us that we need to have some culture in Alberta, which, you know, it's obviously somebody who's never been to Alberta. So I think our culture is drastically different here than it is in Toronto, drastically different than it is in Montreal. And those differences create the grounds where we feel like we could already be in a different country with those people. And then you add to that the very significant economic incentive that we have to no longer be part of this parasitic entity who's really taking so much more money from us. My own ChatGPT math, I spent about an hour running through scenarios and trying to figure out, like, if we took all of the services that the federal government offers to Albertans and replaced them one-to-one with the same services at the same price offered by the province. And I'd like to think, like, there's not a lot of services the federal government provides. I'd like to think that it would be pretty easy to do a better job cheaper than the nonsense that they offer. You know, the passport system is one of the dumbest systems in the world. But even if we can't do a better job, even if it's just one-to-one replacement, that would mean that the average Albertan, if we separated on day one and stopped paying transfer payments, it means the average Albertan would save $17,000 to $25,000 a year. And that's just a lot of money. That's money that people need. And that's money that people need to get out from under the crushing debt and crushing cost of living crisis that the Liberals have created with all of the money that they've already printed. So when you add that cultural difference to just the very significant direct financial incentives that lead people away, I think the timeline is soon. And I predict, and have predicted in the past, I'm saying Alberta will be out of Canada by the end of 2026. And that, I think, is going to be the linchpin for a whole bunch more of the very similar things from around the world. We're going to see jurisdictions, all of these current small wannabe breakaway regions are going to see what we did and they're going to do it. And the logic is just not there. We're going to see a lot of countries breaking up, and my prediction is that we're going to have a lot more countries and a lot fewer currencies. We're probably going to have several thousand countries 10 years from now and maybe 7 or 8 currencies.
Yeah, I love this topic with you. I could talk about it for hours, Dave. It's it's a fascinating, you know, thought. And to even, you know, Dalio and changing world order, it's like the signs really are everywhere that the current status of things has exhausted its ability to maintain itself. And we're at the end of really an unprecedentedly long experiment in pure fiat currency. You know, it's over 50 years now, right? Where money has been entirely pretend. So yeah, it's hard to imagine it going on for another 50, but they do also say, and you said this yourself, right? Money printing can go on for a really long time. And I mean, especially with the US.
It's the way that every Ponzi scheme goes. I don't know if you've ever paid attention to a Ponzi scheme while it was going on, but they really ramp up slow and then they go gradually, then suddenly. And the collapse of every Ponzi scheme is really fast. And it's really about knowing, like, running a successful Ponzi scheme, if you're a central banker or an internet fraudster, is really about knowing how much you can grift and how fast. And grifting too fast ends things real quick. It results in hyperinflation and acceleration. And that's the mistake that they've been making, is they've lost the plot on how fast they can grift us, and are now grifting us too fast, and we're noticing, and so they're screwed.
We'll just have to see how it plays out. That might be a good breakpoint, Dave. Any like final thoughts you want to pass on, or send anywhere you want to send listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I'll send everybody to all of my socials, and you can find me as Bitcoin Brains on basically everything. I have my own little mini podcast you can find on my Twitter called The Bitcoin Hour, where I just rant about random things like this and try to make the world a better place by ranting at it. And yeah, as always, you know, we're a little ways away from it right now, but we're just about to launch early bird tickets, the mega early bird tickets for the 2026 Bitcoin Rodeo. We had our best Bitcoin Rodeo yet the end of June. And got lots of great feedback, and we're pretty energized and excited to plan the next one very early. And other than that, I think that's everything I have to shout out.
A Bitcoin Rodeo was recognized in a Forbes magazine article as being one of the 10 best Bitcoin events in the world.
Unfortunately, Forbes was not recognized in my list of things worth reading.
Doesn't surprise me.
That does sound great that it was recognized in there. So,
Dave, it's always a pleasure, man. And we'll definitely do this again sooner than we did the last one. So I think that we managed to make it to the end with properly functioning audio and video. And if you are listening, you might have made it all the way to the end of the episode. I want to thank you as well for tuning in. And hope to see you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.